biodiversity loss is an existential threat that is fundamental.
The biodiversity breakdown.
5 years ago, in May 2019,
I'm Ruth Thaw.
The Dáil declared a climate and biodiversity emergency.
Amendment is carried.
This dawn chorus was recorded last May. And yes, it's glorious, but it is a lot quieter and less diverse than even 5 years ago. Across the country, we've seen catastrophic declines of birds, wild bees and native plants. Even once common species of our farmland and open countryside, like the kestrel and lapwing, are now in trouble. The intensification of farming and forestry since the 70s led to biodiversity losses as we switched from hay to silage, as stock numbers grew, as pesticides increased, and as wetlands and bogs were drained and reclaimed. Directed by policy and payments, more and more land was brought into production, and there was less and less space for wildlife. Yet if we're to reverse or even halt these losses, it is across Irish farmland that change will happen. If it's to happen at all, farmers are the ones who can turn this crisis around, and some have made a start. My name is Mary Brophy, and across a spring and autumn, I spent time with some Donegal farmers who are farming with nature as they create or conserve habitats on their farms and doing what they can to protect wildlife and their living. These are the nature farmers.
Okay, we'll just walk on here. I heard a saying one time that living on a farm without nature is like living in a house without furniture. It still functions, but there's an awful lot missing. And that's the way I come up here occasionally. Now, I'm not a tree hugger, but I come up here sometimes a Sunday afternoon and sit down for half an hour. And Jesus, it's lovely. I don't have to go and look at the bank statement if I don't want to.
It's early spring, and I'm on Strahack Farm on Inch Island. Boyd Bryce has farmed here all his life. Strahack was his grandparents' farm. And together with his wife Bride, Boyd has spent a lifetime improving the farm with nature to the fore, which made him something of an outlier down the years.
You can see here now we have rock outcrops in this field, which were always covered with blackthorn bushes and scrub. And if I had followed fashion over the years, those bushes would all have been removed and the bare rock would be sticking out and everyone would be happy. I would be getting my single farm payment on it. I never succumbed to the temptation. In fact, I never even took the advice because I was advised by department officials, for goodness sake, to get out of the middle of that field. I said, there's nothing underneath there, only rocks. Doesn't matter, he says, you'll get your single farm payment if you take them bushes out of there. I didn't. Now I'm on an NPWS farm plan. Part of the plan is an enclosure. We've put a fence around them and we've unplanted them with a few small bushes and trees, hazel and birch and stuff, to keep the sheep out of it and let nature take its course and turn it into a mini woodland.
But they're like hundreds of years old. That.
If anybody ever sees a photograph taken from Fawn of Inch, and I've seen one 100 years old, as you say, I'm 120 years old, those outcrops were there, obviously, and they were always covered in bushes.
Those sheep still haven't lambed. The first flock, we sort of have two flocks, we're upwards of 400 sheep.
As we climb the hill from the shoreline, the sheep's bleating fades, and birdsong grows louder.
So where are we now, Boyd?
We're in a small oak wood. Prior to 1994, this hillside was covered in bracken. And in the summertime, the bracken was 5-6 foot tall. It was absolutely amazing stuff. There were children who got lost in it one time. I remember them squealing. They went hysterical. The forestry grant schemes came in the 1990s, and I always had a liking for trees and planting trees, so I took advantage and I planted this particular part of the hill here. I wasn't going to benefit financially very much from anything that I planted here, so I thought the best just to plant the best I could. So the best I could plant here was oak, and from an environmental point of view.
We can hear a chiff-chaff there calling in the background. That's the first of the summer migrants, and from Africa. The vegetation here has changed completely. Well, obviously it's covered in trees, that's the first start, but underfoot this has turned into a bluebell wood, and it's an amazing place in April, May for bluebells. They have completely colonised the whole area. Woodland stuff has moved in. Wood sorrel. What's that there? That's that stitchwort. But they think that children got lost in the bracken, and now we have an open woodland. All the wee plants you like to mention completely changed. And on the back side, on the Rathmullen side, the northwestern side where we planted the conifers, we have red squirrels. And the red squirrels came on to Inch about, I suppose, maybe 10 years ago now. At the moment, we have a hide over there, and you can sit and watch red squirrels taking peanuts out of a feeder if you're so inclined. Jays are quite common in here now. No woodpeckers yet. I'm waiting every day for Drummond, but they're up as far as Sligo and Leitrim. So everything has changed, and it's a whole new habitat.
But you've planted, you said, 60 acres on what is a 400 acre farm. That's a lot of ground to be given over to trees, is it?
It is, but it never was farmland as such. The only thing I could have prospered from here was building sites. And anybody that knows me knows that was a non-runner. So no, I never was into that. So it would have been much more financially benefit, but I never was big into money either. So
10 years ago, Boyd got involved in the Inch Grey Partridge Project, a project trying to create a suitable habitat on Inch Island for grey partridge and other ground nesting birds. One of Ireland's rarest farmland birds, their main diet is insects and vegetation found on cereal farms. Boyd's farm became the host farm for the project, and every year he and local farmers bred and released chicks into the wild.
We put a lot of time and effort into it. We released hundreds of grey partridge. We had the farmers growing crops for their benefit. And the whole thing failed. In the case of nature conservation, you need habitat, and you need food, and you need freedom from predators. The example of the three-legged stool. We had the habitat, the farmers sowed the stuff. We did feed them well in the winter with artificial, with wheat. The weak link appeared to predators, sparrowhawks being the major culprit, foxes obviously. And then food-wise, we could feed the adults, we couldn't feed the chick. The chick, when hatched, was the size of a bumblebee. Had he survived in the wild, and it had to find food, and the food that it had to find was insects. And again, I'm not a scientist, but I don't think we have any insects. Not enough insects in the countryside anymore. We had partridges and partridge nests that hatched successfully. One in particular where she sat on 20 eggs and hatched 15 chicks and left the nest with 15 following her. And within a fortnight, she had none.
Was it a real kind of statement of how poor the ecosystem is at all of those levels?
I am old enough to remember the very last wild grey partridge in the 1960s. What has changed since the 1950s and 60s? Well, it doesn't take college education to work that one out. Our farming practices have changed and will continue to change. You can't turn back the clock. We're not going to go back to the horse and cart. It's not very obvious as you walk about from day to day, because it's so slow and so insidious that you don't notice it. But if you happen to have fortunate to have a long life like I've had and an interest all of my life, I can turn the clock back and see the terrible differences. Like, even in the farming and the type of farming we're doing and how much sprays and stuff we use. I read someplace, I thought it was a very good statement, 40 shades of green that we're renowned for has turned into two shades. It's either ryegrass green or Sitka spruce green, neither of which produces much by way of insects for a partridge chick or anything else for that matter.
But do you see, having farmed the way you farmed and being an outlier in that, that it may not reverse, but that we're completely out of balance now, that something has to change and rebalance things? Or do you have no hope for that happening at all?
Well, all through my life we've had various ups and downs and taken off in different directions, and official advice has been go this way, and then 10 years later says, oh no, you've put too many sheep in the hull, take them all off again, you've done this wrong, you haven't enough cows, let's get some more cows, now we have too many cows, so who knows what will happen in years to come. Somebody might waken up some morning and say, no, we've overdone it. But to be quite honest, I don't see you putting the 1960s back in the environment, no matter how hard you try. Unless in a nature reserve or some place specifically for that. Because, quite frankly, if you're in debt to the bank to the tune of 100,000 because you built a new milking parlour or you got on two new robots or something, chaffs don't pay any rent, like. So unfortunately that's the road we're going, like. We're still going the same way. The new cap may bring a difference, but I won't be holding my breath. I don't see corncrakes back in the silage fields anytime soon.
Boyd's a pragmatist, but he also doesn't give in easily. Despite the odds, he tells me about plans to create even more habitats for wildlife on the farm this summer.
The partridge idea was that you only sowed the margins, because partridge were a creature of margins. But I've got now involved with National Parks farm plan. We're a couple of wee fields now marked out, and we're going to plough the entire field, 3 or 4 acres in each case, and sow it with some form of wildlife cover. It'll provide food and stuff up until and probably after Christmas and that time of year, you know.
And when are you doing that? When are you starting that?
That'll be done this spring. I haven't got it ploughed yet, but it's in the 5-year plan.
This is what we call the bottom farm, you know. It's a farm where I've done most of the measures that I've done for the CAP. You know, I've multi-species ward, the green barns, the ponds, everything else, the shelter belts is down here on this farm. My father farmed here, he inherited it off his uncle. You know, so we've been here, and I don't know how long, they've been here for forever before that.
This is James Breslin, and we're on his family farm at Tullynavin in Ishone. James has deep roots in this farm, but his is a landscape of small and part-time hill farmers. The age profile is getting older, and most need off-farm income to survive. So could farming with nature help ease some of that pressure?
No, just I want to introduce you to Ross Buchanan here. He's the local forester in the area.
Today, I've come to see some of the habitats James has created as part of a local agri-environment scheme that aims to answer that question.
Is this one of the ponds that you...
This is one of the ponds here we're looking at, you know, and I know very little about ponds, but there's frogs in it, there's flies in it, there's algae, there's, I don't know, whatever you see there, you know. That one in 2020 as well.
And you've got frogs already into it?
Yeah, there are definitely frogs. There were frogs spawning there earlier on, I've seen the spawns, you know, and there's a fair few flies in it, but it's early yet, you know, there are not too many flies about yet, you know. Later on when it gets a bit warmer, you'll see a lot more activity around it, so.
And you did a bit of additional planting here with the local Rivers Trust.
Yeah, that's right. So want a few
pond plants around the margins.
I put a few
flag iris and stuff like
that. I'm not sure what they are to tell you. So I just planted.
Are you knocking out your botany book now, James, and checking off all these species?
He left me some stuff and I said I planted, and so I did, you know.
So where, like, I see some of the
flag iris.
The flag iris here, yeah. And what else did you plant, did you say?
Some types of sage. Were bulrushes planted?
There were definitely bulrushes, I honest. What do you call that? Tall grass there, that big broadleaf grass, what do you call it, or so?
That might be the flag iris.
Oh, maybe it was.
So when you put that in, did you have to put a liner down?
It was just
to begin with.
A hole dug in the ground, you know, and the wee stream comes down here.
You've got it.
Runs into it, and there's an outlet there just to keep it from washing away, you know, when it rises so high, there's an outlet for it, you know. So, but whatever it does, it's not doing me a lot of harm anyway, so if it does any good for the environment or, you know, biodiversity, whatever. But
it's a great wee corner for nature. Yeah. You can actually see here, you see how it's shallower at this end?
Yes.
That's because a lot of salt that's been washed down by this farm drainage system has actually been captured here in the pond.
The silt is coming into here.
Yeah, and that otherwise would have washed on down into the river, you know, and it would land on top of fish spawning beds, it would introduce P and N into the system and cause.
But is it creating any problem for the pond?
No, it's not for the pond, you know. And ultimately, if he wants, he can clear that out over time.
Once it builds up so much, you know, take it out again.
Just even as we stand here now, it is a lovely spring morning and the sun is, just baking here at this point. But as well as the spring water that you can hear coming, I can hear a lot of bumblebees.
Definitely, if you're down here, you know, on a good warm day, on your own with no interference from nobody, you can hear a lot of things that you haven't heard for a long time. You know, you can hear birds, bees, frogs. You can hear them croaking. You know, different things. Even flies. You know, they make certain noises. You can hear everything. If you sit and listen, that's wonderful what you can hear.
It's not doing you any harm, it's probably doing you some good too.
Well, this is it, like, you know, it's definitely not doing me no harm, and like, I don't know the advantages of it yet, but they tell me there is, you know, to everything, to biodiversity, to nature, to everything. So hopefully,
even to yourself there now, it sounds like it's, you're getting something out of it.
Well, listen, it makes you feel good whenever you hear the amount of noises that you do hear, you know, wherever they're coming from, because they're nearly extinct up to this last wee while, I don't know.
And that's the thing though, like, there were, before the CIP started, there were no ponds, really.
The land
left
had been drained
on Inishowen at all.
No, the main thing was get everything as dry as you could so that you can go over with a bigger machine than you could yesterday. If you have a dryer tomorrow, you can go over with a bigger tractor and a bigger slurry tanker and, you know, do no harm, you know, but maybe it's not all about that.
In 2019, James and 24 other farmers joined a local EIP, or European Innovation Project, spearheaded by Henry O'Donnell. Around the country, these EU-funded schemes have brought farmers and scientists together to road test new ideas that are good for the environment and farm income.
There were areas fenced off for environmental schemes before, and the minute the scheme was over, like, the fence was taken down, stock was put back into it, everything was just put back to normal. It was just tick a box exercise, but we wanted to come up with something that we thought was viable and could make us money as well as help the environment. Between us, we came up with the scheme, and Henry was the brains behind it, you know, so everybody seems to be happy enough. Different people do different measures, you know. I'm doing the 5 measures. There's cattle back to uplands, there's ponds, there's diverse sward, there's agroforestry, there's red clover, you know, so I agreed that I would take on all the tasks, you know, but not everybody did. I don't think anybody else took on the 5 tasks, only myself, but some of them took on 2 or 3 or 4, whatever, you know, whatever suited. Yeah. So rather than tell people what to do, it was left up to the people, you know. You tell your boss what you want to do, you know, and he'd try to accommodate you, you know, so.
A lot of these environmental schemes now are coming from the ground up, like, they're being led by farmers.
A lot of them is, there's no question about that. Like, it was before the EIP started that if you fenced off a bit of your land to grow a bit of agroforestry, to create a pond, to do anything for the environment, right away, you know, you lost your single farm payment, you were ruled out of your ANC, you lost any scheme that was, you know, going. You only got 4 that specific job that you were doing, which could have been very minimal. Like, there was very little agroforestry. I think there was no agroforestry there for a couple of years. But at least now that we've got this, what they call green lined, in the area we fence off now for an environmental procedure, like, it's, you get your payment on it. You get all your payments, or whatever payments that you're entitled to. So that was a big thing, and getting our scheme off the ground, because I think there would have been very little ponds or trees planted if we had been docked from other payments, you know, because of it.
And is nature a secondary, kind of almost
nature
happy byproduct?
Secondary to likely two-thirds of them, till a certain extent. You know, none of them would, you know, if we've seen a butterfly, they won't be running to kill it or anything. But, like, they just love to see them, but they want everything to be fit to work together.
Yeah.
They want to be fit to farm and keep the birds and the bees as such.
Yeah. And for yourself, like, you're a self-confessed non-tree hugger.
I'm definitely not a tree hugger, but there's a place for everything.
Let's go and have a look at some of these trees.
I'll be on James's farm again next week, but now I'm heading to Inch Nature Reserve. Reserves are often a last refuge for some of our most precious species. Farming continues on and alongside many of them. And while there can be a tension in ensuring a balance that favours nature, certain habitats need some farming. I'm meeting National Parks and Wildlife Service Conservation Officer Martin Toy to discover more about one of Inch's distinct winter visitors.
We're basically at the edge of Inch Lake down here now, on some of the farmland that was reclaimed from the sea back in the 1800s by construction of a kind of a dam or a dike. So when the tides aren't full, or when there's high tides in the Swally here, this land here would be all below sea level. They're feeding as mainly on grassland or stubble. Now, if there were potatoes sown too, and after the harvest, and there were potatoes left behind in the field, they will go to that, and they'll feed on that too for a while. But the fact that the lake and the coastland is so close, coastline is so close to us here, the roost site is on the edge of the lake, so everything's so convenient for them here. Plus, if you take a look around, the amount of ground that's here that's readily available for feeding it, they're massive fields, and there's grass in every one of them, and it's kind of ideal for them, you know.
In the field behind us here, we can see some of the whooper swans. Tell me about them. Where are they coming from?
They're a winter visitor. This is March now, the end of March. They'll be heading within the next couple of weeks now, and they'll leave here, and they will spend the summertime in Iceland. They'll breed there, and they'll be back here next winter time again, and that's just basically the same cycle all the time. So what we have here then is, it's kind of the first feeding ground that they have when they're on the way from Iceland, and it's nearly the last feeding ground that they'll have on the way there.
A swan census took place in 2020, and over 19,000 hooper swans were recorded in Ireland, an incredible increase of 27% since the previous count in 2015.
In 1 month in 2021 here, we had over 1,200 hooper swans in one field of barley. A large percentage of the hooper swans that winter in Ireland, it's the second largest wintering site in Ireland for those, the other one being the Slablands in Wexford.
When you think about a reserve or a nature reserve, nowadays we kind of think of something that's closed off and separated from other land use. But with the hooper swans, like, the farming land is really important for them. Like, you're trying to manage a reserve with a working farm as the feeding, like, does that create challenges?
What we have in place in some areas is farm plans, that where we're actually working with the local farmers, where they have a plan in place where the farmer wouldn't put the crop on so early, wouldn't put the cattle out to graze so early, so that there would be a certain amount of grassland there for them. This is particularly key at this time of year, whenever they're flying off, that there's plenty for them to eat before they go.
They won't be going for a few weeks yet, but for now, it seems this habitat is working for the hooper swans.
worldwide, I'm not sure whether you could say that the numbers were as completely stable or not, but my own personal opinion is it's great to see a positive, that something actually working, that numbers are actually rising. It's encouraging.
Next time on Nature Farmers.
Before that, if you fenced something off like this or planted trees, right away your payments was cut.
So you can imagine how much that policy has contributed to habitat loss over the years. Like, it's insane.
Nature Farmers was directed and presented by Mary Brophy. It is produced by Neil Boyle. It is an IWR media production for Highland Radio, funded by Commission Na Mban with a television licence fee.